Hello and welcome to Interesting Times, found on the web at http://www.xmail.net/interestingtimes/. This segment focuses on a 1971 lecture by Dr. Stuart Crane titled Wheat Receipts, an examination of the International Monetary Fund and the history of international banking. This lecture, recorded in 1971 outside Los Angeles, California, features a man named Stuart Crane explaining the International Monetary Fund, its dynamics, and its history. If you've ever wondered why economic depressions and recessions, the boom and bust business cycle, wars, and the consolidation of international financial power occur, you're in for a treat because Dr. Crane lays it out clearly and simply. In this, the second of two parts, Dr. Crane focuses specifically on the history of international banking as it appears today, and some of the key players who have taken part in its formation.
Let's take a little history. Back in 1762, a man named Mayer Rothschild started out a little banking house. He had five sons. There was a monopoly set up going on in Europe at that time. Napoleon, a man who mysteriously rose to power, wasn't even a Frenchman, puts on a continental policy. Nobody could import into Europe anything by law of Napoleon. The English government, the enemy of Napoleon, put a law, a blockade around Napoleon. No one could ship to Napoleon. Obviously, there could be no shipping. But only one family was allowed in broad daylight to run both the French and the British blockade and run the ships from England and anywhere in the world into Holland and deliver goods at fantastically high prices because of the monopoly established by both governments, with Nathan Rothschild in England and his brothers on the continent distributing the goods. They became extremely wealthy. In 1815, Nathan Rothschild in England, after the Battle of Waterloo, received the news 2 hours before anybody else of who won, or maybe he even knew before then. But he started selling publicly government bonds. The government would be financially collapsed if Napoleon won at Waterloo. If Wellington won, the bonds were good. Publicly, Nathan Rothschild started selling government bonds, British government council, and he started selling them in a panic to get rid of them, screaming, trying to get rid of them at any price. The prices fell and fell and fell. In 2 hours, they fell 95%. And he had all of his agents buying the bonds as everybody else rushed to sell theirs, and in 10 minutes, he bought the British government. Not bad for a little operation for an afternoon, you know. In 1820, when the French government was financing itself through a new bond issue, all the French bankers were invited in by the king, and Napoleon, or Louis Rothschild, who built himself a little house exactly like Versailles, was sitting out in the anteroom because he wasn't invited. Louis Rothschild was sitting there in his white ermine garments with his big coach and 12 white horses and everything out there and all his liverymen, and he's just sitting out in the anteroom. In a few minutes, people started scurrying in and out of the palace. The French bond market had just collapsed. And Rothschild is sitting out there twiddling his thumbs as the King of France comes out and bows to Louis Rothschild and invites him in. And Louis Rothschild bought the government of France. Solomon Rothschild is on in Vienna. He is financing his friend and the partner, Prince Metternich, who is running the Holy Roman Empire, Austria-Hungary, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, what is now that whole area. He couldn't even own property in Austria. He just owned the government and the emperor, which wasn't bad for a little boy. He's just trying to make good. What about Calvin Rothschild, the youngest boy? Well, he arrived kind of late, but he arrived down in Naples, opened up the Rothschild Bank of Naples. Within a few years, he had every kingdom in Italy, which, remember, was not a nation yet, so heavily in debt to him, including one little kingdom called the Vatican. In fact, he had the Vatican so in debt to him by 1842 that Calvin Rothschild ordered the Pope to invite him to the Vatican and feed him kosher in public at a public banquet. Which was rather humiliating, particularly when the Pope got up and asked him if he would refer to Rome as the holy city. Calvin got up and said, "Jerusalem is the holy city," which didn't help the Pope at all. But you know, there are times you can't say anything. It's called diplomacy, isn't it?
Do not fast forward.
Well, the oldest son sitting up on Frankfurt on the Main. Well, Ishmael found this nice young German count, a baron actually, who was a young ambitious fellow, wanted to go somewhere, seemed to be a fairly bright boy. So he took this little boy in and financed his little career. The man's name was Otto von Bismarck, the Iron Chancellor, the man who wielded it and built Germany. They did pretty good. Now notice, in Europe, after every war, how there had to be two powers, groups of powers of equal size, called balance of power. Why? You've got to make sure all King A's can be threatened by King B's, and B's by A's. But you need somebody on the outside to change the power. What was that? England. Nathan Rothschild in England, and you had Louis in France, and Solomon in Austria. Notice the center of every militant group, or the coalition, was Vienna and Paris. With Nathan Rothschild's England staying on the outside as the whip saw which way the thing was to go. You could watch which way the victor was going to be in every war by which way England went. The problem was, when the game came up in 1914, England wasn't enough to throw the battle. So they got a new one, called the United States, to do England's rule. But anyway, notice you've got to have a way of collecting. You also got to have government debt if you're going to get money away. Notice, a man belonged to a very wealthy club back in the 1840s. This club, made up of the most wealthy and powerful people in Europe, called the League of Just Men, had two very, of which now are famous people. At that time, they were practically unknown. They were just small members of this. They were really kind of the cloakroom boys, named Frederick Engels and Karl Marx. Engels and Marx wrote a book, which they were hired to write by the club, the League of Just Men, which later changed its name to the Brotherhood of Communists, to write a book of the necessity, watch the second plank of the platform, of a progressive personal individual income tax, and the necessity of a central bank. Why? You need a central bank to be able to collect the money from the government legally. And you need an income tax to collect it legally from the people. Notice the income tax was passed to take it away from the rich and give it to the poor. May I give the Internal Revenue's testimony before the United States Senate in 1969 on the Internal Revenue Act. When they said that in 1968, those people earning more than $20 million in that year paid less than 7% income tax. Those people earning over $600,000 half paid no taxes whatsoever. 85% of the entire personal income tax came from the lowest tax bracket. It's not tax rich and give it poor. There are 100,000 tax-free foundations that pay no tax. These foundations, let's take the Rockefeller and the Ford and the Carnegie Foundation, with their fabulous millions, support the left-wing schools of the United States. In fact, the schools of education teaching the teachers, the 20 largest schools in the United States in the last 50 years have received over half their entire endowments from two, the Carnegie and the Rockefeller Foundation. Therefore, what these kids are learning today is what they want them to learn. What is that? You need a Federal Reserve to stabilize. We need government control of the money system to stop depression. We have to have the Federal Reserve Bank is next to God, isn't it? And they're taught that in the school. But look at something. You take any econ textbook, and what does it do? It spends almost all of its time trying to show you how to prevent a business cycle and the cause of the business cycle. But I will tell you the cause, and I can do it by saving you right now 300 pages of reading. The only cause of a business cycle is the change in the availability of credit. And availability of credit is changed by the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve is owned by the bank, not the government. I will show you something else. I was over the other day, the chief economist of a large bank in the United States had me over 3 nights ago over to his home. He said, I have a very startling piece of information. I looked at it and I said, I've been saying this all along. It's nice to have your chart to verify. That is that every business cycle is never fought by the Federal Reserve. Notice they always make a mistake. Their timing is off on tight and loose money. But if you will check, their timing is perfect if you want to assume that they create the business cycle. They tighten money and a bust happens. They loosen it and prosperity happens. Now watch something. If I was a governor of the Federal Reserve Board and I knew we're going in there, we're going to pass some tight money, would I hold my own personal stock? Or would I sell them, knowing the market's going to go down? If I knew we were going to go pass loose money policy, I know the market's going up, right? Would I be so stupid as not to buy stock? Now notice, if I had that information, I have to get rich. I don't see the governors getting poor. They get richer. Now there's some other people who keep getting richer. For an example, here is Rocky, who got me my job on the board of governors, and we're having dinner. What I say, and Rocky says, how do you think the market's going to go? What I say, it's all right when I know we just passed tight money today. Or what I say, I would think it wouldn't be advisable to hold too much stock right now. I mean, just as a friend, wouldn't you tell a friend what you felt the market was going to do if he asked you? Those people who are friends would get richer. How do you keep this little system where those certain people know? For an example, this man was telling me, this vice president of the bank, that his offices are right below the Lehman Brothers, who are real insiders in New York. And a week before, he's sitting there talking to Ball, George Ball of the State Department, who's now back with Lehman Brothers. And Ball was saying, you're out of stocks, aren't you? And he says, what do you mean I'm out of stocks? And he says, don't you know about Cambodia? This is a week before Cambodia. Sure, they all were out. Why? Certain people get advance news or give the orders. Where did Nixon live the 4 years before he became president? In Rockefeller's apartment building in New York, a $100,000 apartment covering the whole floor. Where did he work? For a law firm whose major client is Standard Oil. Who do you think he says yes, sir, to? Rockefeller established in 1919 an organization called the Council of Foreign Relations. We have some interesting members of this little club. Not only the Rockefellers, but every president of the Federal Reserve Board in its history. Thomas Dewey, Adlai Stevenson, Dwight David Eisenhower, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, Richard Milhouse Nixon, Hubert Horatio Humphrey. You can have Tweedledick or Tweedledumfrey. You go down the polls and think you vote and you decide prosperity, depression. You decide these things by voting once every 4 years, and that's your civic duty you've carried. Look, at even when Humphrey wins, Nixon wins. And when Nixon won, Kennedy won. If you don't happen to vote the way the newspapers have told you that they control, the school teachers who've been turned out of their factories to support the idea of a controlled economy, I'm going to tell you something. There is nothing in the economy to cause a business cycle outside of a Federal Reserve. Without the Federal Reserve, you couldn't have a depression. In 1923 to 28, the Federal Reserve was making money plentiful. It increased the amount of loans on stock alone from $2 billion to $10 billion, just under $10 billion. And inflated the whole stock market. Then what did they do in the spring of 1929? They started tightening their money. Notice, by March, Bernard Brooke was sold out. In June, the Rockefellers were out. In July, the Kennedys were out. You go right down the line, and all of them, the Lehmans were out, everybody else is out, and the money is tightening and tightening, and the crash comes. And while the crash was on, remember, the Federal Reserve was supposed to make money available to everybody, then why were the banks closing? Why were the little country banks who weren't members of the big club in New York closing? But Chase Manhattan, the largest bank, bought by John D. Rockefeller in 1904, didn't close. New York City Bank, the second biggest bank in New York, bought by William Rockefeller in 1904, didn't close. Couldn't there be something? Here you see Gus Hall saying we're going to take away Rockefeller's millions and give it to the poor. But Rockefeller doesn't put his money in the Birch Society. In fact, Rockefeller puts his money in the left wing, doesn't he? He puts it in the school, turning out people who hate this country and hate the free enterprise system. Why? He hates the free enterprise system. The enemy of him is a competitor. You notice when one of those poor boys like Teddy Roosevelt got elected to fight the monopoly. Did the monopolies become less or more? Did the big businesses become less or more? You see, in the 1900s, small businesses were popping up everywhere, weren't they? Competition against the big businesses were everywhere. Everybody could go into business, and everybody was. In every town, sure, Standard Oil would come in and dump oil to wipe you out, right? But what happened? The day they raised the price and wiped you out, you went back in business again. It wouldn't work. They had to get Teddy in there to start setting up the legal monopoly, the regulations, the controls on how much oil could be pumped under conservation, so that you couldn't get a license to pump oil while Standard Oil could. What do you think conservation programs are for? Only those people with a license can do it. What about crop control, wheat control, cotton control? Why? You don't get a license, your land is worthless, is it? You can't grow cotton unless you get a government certificate. The people in the know get the certificate. The people who finance and give the right money to the right party and the right candidate get the certificate. You play ball, you get the certificate, don't you? If you don't, you don't get a certificate. But how do you keep this whole game going? You could never get off with it unless you had government schools which were financed, not by the parents, not willingly, but the money was taken by force. And so the teacher does not teach what the parents want, but teaches what the state wants. And if you think the state is independent, it is not. People say, well, what about in England? When the wealthy, when the big banks were nationalized, well, you would think that they lost out, wouldn't you? Unless the people of the big banks own the government, then all they really did is merge in their competitors' banks and own the whole shooting range. If you think of the government as an independent agency, then they lost. If the government is a holding company, then they won. You see, there's some different theories. Theory that the Federal Reserve fights depression, or a theory it causes depression. The evidence supports strongly the latter. We have a theory that inflation is supposedly caused by wage-price spirals, isn't it? I want to tell you something. I've had 11 years of economics. I'm going to give you a little clue. I'm going to encapsulate it right in a matter of a minute, because that's about all we have when we've got a couple of minutes. All the workers can strike all they want, and they can't get a wage increase unless the businesses can pay. No matter how brutal a strike is, no company can get into it unless they can pay the wage increase. The company can't give in unless they can get the increase from the customer. The customer can't pay them unless there's an increase in the money supply so that they can pay the higher price. Second, if there is an increase in the money supply, the customers will bid against each other and force prices up, which labor will demand a bigger share of and will go on strike. Labor and business don't cause inflation. Increase of the money supply does. See, and neither business nor labor can cause inflation because they can't increase the money supply. Only the government or the central bank can cause inflation. All inflation is caused by the central bank. The blame, however, is never taken by the central bank. Why? They endowed the schools to teach the teachers to teach your kids that it was business and labor. Why? So we're going to need wage and price controls to control the producers of the nation, every bread earner in this country, to fight inflation. Because they've been writing too many phony wheat receipts. It's your fault. You people who want higher wages just because the prices go up. It's your fault. You people who raise your prices because your customers are willing to pay more. You're the dirty people. Not the people who have printed more money. We're given a con game. But Satan is the father of lies. Right? And that's the world system. You worship the world system, you're going to get taken. You see, the one thing that a con artist needs is for you not to believe he's a con artist. And believe that he's straight up. The one thing the con artist needs is the ability to give you all your information so you don't get it from anywhere else. Somebody else might tell you the truth. That's why they tell you, don't listen to these people, don't listen to those, and don't join. How about these radicals and these extremists and these fundamentalists and all these other things, right? Because they might give you a different point of view, and that would be dangerous. And they spent a lot of time building a lot of schools and doing a lot of conniving to get a system to indoctrinate you on radio, television, newspapers, hammer you in the schools and get the textbooks and everything else, all pointing to one thing. How wonderful the government is, how it's trying to solve all your needs and your problems, how they're managing the money in order to keep you from losing, how they're taking away your money to take care of your old age, only you pay four times for Social Security, but any private company would sell you the same insurance policy for. Your rates are 400%. In the United States government. For Medicare, what you pay for Medicare, which gives you a hospital bed without a doctor at the age of 65, a private insurance company, assuming you start paying the rates at 18, will write you a policy to give you a doctor and a hospital bed and cover you from the age 25 for the rest of your life. How does the government sell that kind of insurance? You gotta buy it, go to jail. What a gimmick. How many salesmen would love that pitch? Any insurance salesman would sure love to sell that insurance, huh? You can't miss. Just sign up everyone. You notice it's all force and deception. You see, there are only two concepts of government. By the way, I just give you a preview. These are little excerpts out of my particular Saturday talk. That's why my wife said, what am I going to say? Well, I just took something out of my talk. Here we go and talk about this at length in a whole series of things, of political concepts and social concepts and educational concepts and what the whole program of the civil rights are about and what the whole program of the peace things are and what the campuses are doing and what the program is to do with the mind. Why? The people who have been writing the wheat receipts don't want you to call them. Let me finish up with just one other little example comes to my mind. Maybe I can jam it in here. This is kind of a short one. How does federal debt come about? Let's see if I can do it in your mind. It's a little difficult. I don't have a blank board here. The government takes a piece of paper and writes a bond. I owe you $100,000. That's called a bond. It's an IOU. They sell it to the Federal Reserve. Wait a minute. Do they sell it to the Federal Reserve? No, they give it to the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve opens up a bank account and allows the government to write checks on an account that isn't theirs. And what does the Federal Reserve use to back up this new bank account that they just invented? Oh, the bond that was just invented is the asset to cover the liability of the new bank account they just invented. So the security against the bank account is the bond that they just wrote, okay? Now, the government writes checks and gives it to people, don't they? Those people think that they're money. They go down, put it in the bank account, and they start buying things. Notice this money came out of nowhere, didn't it? Now there's more money, but no more goods. The government didn't produce any. So the extra money chases the existing goods. What happens? The price of all existing goods must go up enough to absorb all the new money. That's called inflation. If the government sells the bonds to the bank, the inflation is equal to the amount of bonds. If the government sells it to the Federal Reserve, it's equal to the amount of borrowing times the reserve requirement. If it's 20% reserve requirement, five times. I won't explain that to you. It's too complicated, but there's a multiplier. If the government sells a bond to a private citizen, there's no inflation. But private citizens don't buy all the debt. In fact, they only buy about 25% of the debt. The other 75%. But how do you get in debt? How do you keep getting this debt to go up so you can write the bonds? Notice, the Federal Reserve, which is a privately owned bank, and the banks to buy these bonds, so they put up nothing for it because they just opened a bank account and backed it with the bonds, do collect interest payments taken from you in the form of income taxes every single year on nothing. They put nothing up for it. They receive 20,000 millions a year of your money taken now legally. But how can they take it legally? You got to get the nation in debt. How do you get in debt? Poverty programs and war. You want to know why we're fighting in Vietnam? Not to fight communism. To raise the debt. We've never taken care of any poverty. Poverty has never decreased or any poverty program, but debt has increased. All of our ABCs has never caused less illegitimate children. It's called more. Caused more. All of our money being poured into schools have not produced more productive people, but less productive people. Not more patriotic people, less patriotic people. Not more moral people, but less moral people. That wasn't what it was for. What it was for is debt. Now, in order to have an excuse to fight all these wars, they need communism. Lenin was financed by Jacob Schiff, Warburg, the Federal Reserve Bank, member of the CFR, Khrushchev a few years ago, David Rockefeller, chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank, and the Standard Oil Company, the number one hate man of the communists in the world, takes his vacation in the Kremlin. Isn't that interesting? When his vacation is over, Khrushchev is no longer premier. Now, I can't prove any connection between the two, but I'm suspicious that the boss came over and fired the branch manager. Khrushchev didn't fire Rocky. A couple years ago, Nelson Rock, last year, before the Senate, he said, I believe that the wealthy of this nation owe it to our country to contribute 5 or 10% of their income in income taxes, even though they don't legally have to pay. 5 or 10%. They take more than that for me, that dirty, rotten crook. And look at Ted Bobby Kennedy in 1966 says, Nelson Rockefeller's a dirty rat. He only paid $685 in income taxes last year. What a rat, because Bobby Kennedy paid none. All of his was in a foundation. In fact, no Kennedy has ever paid any income tax. No Kennedy, they've only paid the whole family property tax once in their life, and that was on the Chicago, the merchandise mart. After John Kennedy was president, they paid at half rate. They wouldn't even go full rate on one building to try to look legit. The Rothschilds, who by 1850 were considered wealthier than all the royal families of the world, have never paid a tax of any sort to any government in history. Take it from the rich and give it to the poor. Isn't that what this game is? Huh? We've been kind. Well, it's happened before. It's happened again. Thank you very much.
Once again, this has been a recording of Dr. Stuart Crane's 1971 lecture titled Wheat Receipts, an examination of the International Monetary Fund and the history of international banking. Interesting Times may be found on the web by visiting http://www.xmail.net/interestingtimes/.